The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McKeonis, and we dipped into our archive. I had forgotten about this interview that I did 17 years ago. And I need to do a little background here, because back in the day, say 2003, when I recorded this interview, we had a lot of writers coming through Dayton on book tour. Some of them were very famous. Some of them totally unknown. We used to get writers who had just published their first book, and no one had heard of them. And some of them are very famous now, all these years later. Well, at the time I scheduled this interview, I wasn't that familiar with the author. I knew he was famous. I knew he had sold a lot of books. But I really wasn't that familiar with him. He called himself Robert Jordan. And he died 4 years after I recorded this interview with him. He was coming through Dayton on book tour. And his pen name was Robert Jordan. His actual name was James Oliver Rigney, Jr. He was born on October 17, 1948. He died on September 16, 2007. He wrote epic fantasy, and he's best known for his Wheel of Time series. At the time I did this interview with him, he had just published his 10th book in that series. It was called Crossroads of Twilight. And when I heard he was coming through town, I thought, well, gosh, he's really famous and his books are really popular and I should probably interview him. But I had never read any of his books. So I read the 10th book, Crossroads of Twilight. And I was totally, completely baffled and lost. I had no clue what was going on. And during this interview, I admitted to him that I had only read the one book, that I hadn't read the previous nine. And he said, if you want to understand his books, you need to start with the very first one. Otherwise, you're going to be completely lost. So he understood. I admitted to him during the interview that I had not read the previous nine books, so I was completely lost. And I think he was cool with that, because he was used to dealing with people who were so devoted to his books. He had this huge fan base, and they loved his books. And at the time he was on the show, he said he had two more books planned in the series. Well, he didn't live long enough to finish the series. In fact, it was finished by another very famous fantasy writer named Brandon Sanderson. In fact, there were 15 books written in the series, I guess. After he died, maybe they decided to do some more. But the first one was called New Spring. It came out in 2004. It was a prequel set before the events of the first novel, which was actually The Eye of the World. Now, I know that's confusing, but if you read them in order, he put out a book the year after I interviewed him that actually goes into the number one slot. So not only was I totally confused that I hadn't read the first book that he had published, but I was totally confused because he wrote another book that then became the first book the following year. So it's all very confusing. And I'll admit that I was confused. Anyway, he was very kind to me. He put up with my questions. And I asked him about his life and I asked him about his writing. And I think it's a very interesting interview. We didn't talk too much about the story, which I did not understand. Jordan was born in Charleston, South Carolina. He served two tours in Vietnam from 1968 to 1970 with the U.S. Army. He was a helicopter gunner. He was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross with Oak Leaf Cluster, the Bronze Star with V and Oak Leaf Cluster, and two Vietnamese Gallantry Crosses with Palm. After returning from Vietnam, he attended the Citadel, where he received an undergraduate degree in physics. After graduating, he was employed by the U.S. Navy as a nuclear engineer. He began writing in 1977. He wrote lots of other books. In this interview, he talked about the fact that he wrote another very famous series of books, or at least he wrote about seven of them, a book that I remember, a series that I remember from my childhood. He also ghost wrote a book that is a very famous book, and to this day, nobody knows he wrote it. Let's listen now to Robert Jordan, recorded back in 2003, talking about his Wheel of Time series. We call it the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'm delighted to have on the program today Robert Jordan. Book 10 of his series, The Wheel of Time, has just come out. It's called Crossroads of Twilight. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Robert, I remember as a kid discovering Middle Earth, and I was never the same again. How did you get into this line of work?
Just lucky, I guess. I used to be an engineer, and I had always said I was going to write one day. Then 20-something years ago, I was injured on the job. I spent a month in the hospital. I nearly died. Decided life was too short to wait, and I started writing. And I've been doing it ever since. I quit my job as an engineer and went off to write.
How did you get into this particular genre of writing?
Fantasy has always interested me. It's a place where you can talk about right and wrong, good and evil, and keep a straight face. In a good deal of mainstream literature, when you have to make excuses for evil, and it's not really evil, after all, it's circumstances or misapplied situational ethics or any sort of thing. I believe sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between what is right and what is wrong, or what is good and what is evil. Sometimes it is difficult to tell the difference, but it's worth making the effort. And you can talk about that sort of thing in fantasy.
And in real life, right now, we're seeing a lot of good versus evil being spoken about in our public discourse.
Well, we are. But I'm never really sure how much you can believe of anything that politicians say, no matter what side they're on.
Mm-hmm. My guess is Robert Jordan. Crossroads of Twilight is book 10 of the series. For folks who haven't read any of the series, I know there's a few people out there that have not discovered this series. What is this world, and where are we now as we enter book 10?
As we enter book 10, well, we are in a world that never was, a world of myth and legend, a world that supposedly exists both in our future and in our past. It is a world that is the source of all of our legends and myths, and we, in turn, are the source of their legends and myths. And as we enter Book 10, Crossroads of Twilight, we are fast approaching the last battle, Thaman Gaiden, where the Dark One, the devil, if you will, is about to break into our world and must be fought. Because if he is not defeated, then everything will be destroyed. The world will be given over to chaos and fire and eternal night.
And as we reach the conclusion of the book, it seems clear that we're just going to keep right on going with this series.
Well, for another two books at least, I have known the last scene of the last book since 1984.
Mm.
I could have written it then. I know exactly where I'm heading. Unfortunately, the story in The Wheel of Time has taken me a little longer to tell than I thought it was going to when I set out. I thought I was beginning a 10K run, uh-huh, and found out somewhere along the line that I had signed up for the marathon.
I was reading some of the biographical material that your publisher sent me, and I was flabbergasted to see that there are over 65,000 discussion groups on your work on the internet. Is that accurate? Wow.
That could very well be accurate. Someone once sent me a partial list, and there were 5 or 10,000 URLs listed in this list, and I was told that the man who sent it to me had simply stopped printing out when he realized how long it was going to keep printing, and he sent me this partial. So I would not be at all surprised to find that there are that many.
When we hear people describe the genre of fantasy, I think it means a different thing to each person that visualizes it. What does it mean to you?
Fantasy is, you might say, a world based on dreams, on things unseen or half-glimpsed, on things that are based on belief rather than any provable reality. If you have a book that has ghosts in it, then it is fantasy. If you have a book that has dragons in it, certainly it's fantasy. I do not have dragons in my books, by the way, nor fairies or elves or any of the other that sort of thing. But it is a book based on what might be rather than what is. That's fantasy.
You mentioned dreams. Do you ever get any ideas from your own dreams for your work?
Not really useful ideas. My dreams are quite often a jumble, you know, the brain clearing itself out of everything that's come in during the day. And I sometimes dream about meeting my characters at a cocktail party, and that sort of thing doesn't really translate into the books.
You served a couple of tours in Vietnam. How has that experience affected your viewpoint of the world and your writing?
Well, it gave me a solid grasp of what being in the middle of a battle is like, certainly. Which is to say, it's all confusion and you don't know what's happening unless you can actually see it. Whatever is happening 50 yards away is an absolute mystery to you, and it still might kill you. I know what it's like to have someone actually trying to kill me personally. And unfortunately, I know what it's like to kill somebody. I also know from that, you could say I gained a sense of betrayal, of the inevitability of it. We all marched off to that with a sense of fulfilling the compact. Young men are told if you go and fight our wars that you will be honored for it. You will stand guard on the wall so that we may sleep safely tonight. But inevitably you come back from that and find out that nobody wants to hold up their side of the bargain. Not unless they were on the wall with you.
The Vietnam War was a war where the returning veterans weren't received very well in comparison to World War II and other wars.
In a great extent, yes. But I also have read and talked. I've also talked to veterans of World War II. And found out that the great bursts of enthusiasm welcoming back veterans of World War II died away very quickly. And then there was a great deal of sense of, just because you've been off in this war, you don't expect to get your job back, do you? The great bursts of enthusiasm welcoming home the World War II vets didn't last very long.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. It's the Best of the Book Nook, my 2003 interview with the fantasy writer Robert Jordan, which will continue right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, my 2003 interview with the late Robert Jordan. He died 4 years after he did this interview. His only appearance in the book Nook. He's best known for the Wheel of Time series, which was finished upon his death by Brandon Sanderson. It comprises 14 books and a prequel novel. He is one of several writers to have written the original Conan the Barbarian novels. His are highly acclaimed to this day. He also wrote historical fiction under the pseudonym Reagan O'Neill, a Western as Jackson O'Reilly, dance criticism as Chang Lung. Additionally, he ghostwrote an international thriller that is still believed to have been written by someone else. Jordan was a history buff. He enjoyed hunting, fishing, sailing, poker, chess, pool, and pipe collecting. He described himself as High Church Episcopalian and received communion more than once a week. He lived with his wife, Harriet McDougall, who works as a book editor still with Tor Books. She was his editor. They lived in a house in Charleston that was built in 1797. Here's Robert Jordan from the Best of the Book Nook.
You're from Charleston, South Carolina, and when I think of Charleston, I always think of the Citadel, and you're a graduate of the Citadel. How did you end up there?
I ended up there because a man named Colonel Bunch called me and recruited me personally. I'd been in Vietnam before this, before I went to the Citadel.
Oh.
And I was all set to go off to a civilian university and study, and he recruited me, I think, in the thought that I would play football for them.
Oh.
But I'd outgrown that sort of thing by the time I went back to school.
I'm guessing after being in Vietnam, football seemed fairly tame.
Tame, and in a way, you could say it was childish. I was done with playing games. It was time to get down to my life.
Tell us about the other things that you've written before this series.
Oh, before I began The Wheel of Time, I wrote 7 Conan novels many years ago.
Conan the Barbarian.
Conan the Barbarian.
Oh,
yes,
my.
Yes, I did. For my sins, I did. I've written a Western, a very unusual Western, set in the late 1830s and early 1840s, in which there was only one major character, who was not a Cheyenne Indian. I've written historical novels about the American Revolution in the South, and the settling of Texas, and the War of 1812, and the war against the Barbary pirates. So I've even ghostwritten a novel, a techno thriller, believe it or not.
Huh.
So I've written a bit of everything.
And when you do the final 2 books on this series, I know you're going to keep writing. Do you have any thoughts about where you'll be headed?
Another fantasy series, very much different from this one, because I don't like to do the same thing over again. This has been mulling around in the back of my head for 7 or 8 years now. I never just sit down and start writing. Things knock around in my head for a number of years before it actually comes out in a book. The Wheel of Time, I guess I spent 10 years thinking about the ideas that would turn into the Wheel of Time before I began writing the first book, The Eye of the World. And I should point out, by the way, for those who have never read me, you must begin with The Eye of the World. If you pick up this new book, Crossroads of Twilight, to start, you may get 10 pages before you decide that you do not understand who these people are. You do not understand what they are doing. You do not understand why they are doing it. And you will throw the book down in disgust. So, if you haven't read me, start with The Eye of the World.
And that is book one.
That is book one.
Well, Robert, I didn't throw the book down in disgust, but you did describe some of my befuddlement there, because I have not read the first book. So I'm...
Well, you see, I took a great chance. I have written a very long multi-volume novel. with the Eye of the World, the first book, I wrap it up with a bit of conclusion. So if you read it and stop there, you feel that you've read something and you can stop. But from then on, I have simply assumed that you've read what has gone before and are willing to understand that you are reading large chunks of a novel. There is a resolution to each one, a summing up, if you will, the resolving of the problems, but there's no explanation of what went before. I assume that what I've already explained has already been explained, and you know it.
And that explains, I think, the fact that your readers are so devoted, because they've really invested a lot of thinking into following these many twisting threads of storyline.
Oh, they have. I constantly receive letters asking intricate questions about details of the story. The readers quite often analyze these stories in incredible depth. I've already had a number of people tell me that they were writing their master's theses on these books.
Huh.
And I've had one approach from someone who says she wishes to use these in her doctoral thesis. So we shall see what happens there.
Who are your fans? Who reads your stuff?
Everybody. When I have a signing, I see a few kids as young as 11 and 12. I see grandparents, 75 and 80. I see teenagers and college students and lawyers and cops and doctors. I sometimes have three and occasionally even four generations of a family come in together with bringing their books, and quite often individual copies, so they won't have to fight over who gets to read it first, which I must say I like that.
I'm going to guess, with so many readers and so much devotion, that you probably have some who are so passionate that they really want to meet you, they really want to find you, and I'm guessing your privacy is really at a premium.
It is. I've had an unlisted phone number for, I guess it's 7 or 8 years now, and I do try to keep as much privacy as I can, because when someone tracks me down and actually knocks on the door, well, I spend 15 minutes with them and maybe sign a book and tell them I really can't spend any more time than that with them, and they go away feeling shortchanged, and then it takes me an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours to get back into the flow of the writing. So I really appreciate the fans who don't come to see me.
I'm thinking of Samuel Taylor Coleridge answering the door and never finishing Kubla Khan, never finishing the Xanadu poem.
Oh, yes.
You just spoke about your writing. I'm wondering, is this a total immersion? What's the process for you? Do you write on a computer? Do you write on a typewriter? Are you a morning writer?
I write on a computer now, and the process is, for me, as soon as I finish breakfast, I go to my computer. I answer the email that I absolutely must answer and the phone calls I absolutely must deal with. I work on the theory that if I ignore it, they will come back to me if it's important enough that I really should pay attention. And after 3 or 4 comebacks, I decide, all right, I guess I have to deal with that now. Otherwise, I start writing and work for 8 or 10 hours and knock off at 6 or 7 or 8 at night. And I do that 7 days a week, occasionally taking a day off. Last year was pretty bad. I only took 5 days off, as near as I can calculate. I do like to go fishing when I can, but I just didn't get to do it very often last year.
I'm impressed with your work ethic, Robert. I think we'd have quite a country if everybody worked as hard as you do.
Oh, I don't know. My wife keeps telling me I need to have more fun.
Uh-huh.
But I do like writing. That's the problem. I really enjoy it.
I'm going to make the supposition that you have a very special place where you live, a special home with an atmosphere that it enhances your thoughts, that makes you feel very comfortable.
Yes, it does. It does. We live in a house that was built in 1797, and I write in the carriage house behind it. And the beautiful gardens. So we really don't need to leave very often.
And Charleston, I've never been there, but I understand it has a very unique atmosphere.
Well, I think so. I've never found anywhere I'd rather live than Charleston.
And you were born there?
I was born there and grew up there.
We were talking before we went on the air that your accent is not very pronounced, and you explained to me how that took place. Number one, the accent in Charleston isn't what you'd expect from the South, and number two, when you were 12 years old, someone worked on that for you.
Yes, the accent, in the Charleston accent, the old Charleston accent, is a combination of 17th century south of England and west of Ireland, and doesn't really sound very southern. The first time I saw a phonetic rendition of how Sir Walter Raleigh would have sounded saying the Lord's Prayer, I fell over laughing because to me it sounded like an Edisto Island accent, which we consider a very country accent around Charleston.
Uh-huh.
But when I was 12, my teacher said to me, "You're very bright. You're going to leave Charleston one day," because that's what you did in those days if you were bright and had ambition. She said, "When you do, everyone will hear your accent and no one will hear what you have to say. I'm going to do something about that." What she did was proceed to eradicate my accent with the aid of a hardwood yardstick. I'm afraid I can't even fake it now. The old accent is gone.
Hickory reinforcement.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I'm wondering what you might think, if you have any thoughts on the current surge of interest in the works of Tolkien and the films and all that. Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
Well, I love the books. I think the movies are excellent. I have enjoyed them immensely. And I think, in part, they are growing in popularity again. The books are, and the movies are growing in popularity, in part because they do talk about confronting evil, and it's a very gritty thing. That you can't sidestep it. These are things that you must do, and you're not going to be aided by overwhelming force. The evil is going to be as strong as you are. You still have to fight it. Maybe it's going to be stronger, but you still have to fight it.
Are there films in the future for this series?
Well, we shall see what we shall see. My agent tells me that there have been a few questions asked, but there hasn't been anybody who's actually coughed up the money yet. So
I'm guessing that when you read for pleasure, you probably like to read history. Is that a good guess?
I read everything for pleasure. History, mysteries, biography, science fiction, anything, a lot of nonfiction of almost every sort imaginable.
Are there any titles that you've read recently that you really enjoyed?
Yes. Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. The nautical chart by good Lord, I'm going to blow his name, Reverte. uh-huh. Arturo Fuentes Reverte, I believe it is. I hope I have his name right. Salt, A Natural History.
Oh, yeah, Mark Kurlansky.
Yes, it was a fascinating book.
Wonderful. I believe he's actually going to be in Dayton in the near future. I'm going to try to track him down.
Oh, well, tell him I said it's a fascinating book. I enjoyed it terrifically.
I certainly will do that. And, Robert, I know book tours can be rather hectic, and I'm sure you treasure your time when you can just kind of lay back and relax. And I'm going to let you do that.
Well, thank you.
Really a pleasure to have you on the program, and next time I want to have you in person. We'll try not to order up a snowstorm for you.
I would love that.
Okay. My guest has been Robert Jordan, and the book is Book 10 of the Wheel of Time series, Crossroads of Twilight. It's just come out. And are you looking for a New York Times listing on that in the near future?
I know sometimes you've been told that the week after next, not this coming Sunday, because we find out a little ahead of time, uh-huh. I will be number one on the New York Times. And in this morning's USA Today, I was number one. And I have been told that Crossroads of Twilight is number one on the New York, on the London Times as well.
Congratulations.
So I'm feeling very set up about that.
You've done it again.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2003 interview with Robert Jordan, who died 4 years after that interview. In March of 2006, he disclosed he had been diagnosed with cardiac amyloidosis, and with treatment, his median life expectancy was 4 years. In a separate blog post, he encouraged his fans not to worry about him, and they stated that he intended to lead a long and creative life. He began chemotherapy at Mayo Clinic in early April 2006. He was enrolled in a study of Relumid, which had recently been approved for multiple myeloma, but not yet tested on his ailment. He died on September 16, 2007. His funeral service was held a few days later. He was cremated, his ashes buried in the churchyard of St. James Church in Goose Creek outside Charleston. His papers can be found in the special collections of the College of Charleston. This is a guy who loved to write. Did you hear him say? He wrote 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. And he said he only took off about 5 days a year. So that's 360 days a year, 10 hours a day. That's 3,600 hours of writing a year. I guess that explains how he was able to write 7 Conan the Barbarian books in just 2 years. He wrote Conan the Invincible, Conan the Defender, Conan the Unconquered, Conan the Triumphant, Conan the Magnificent, Conan the Destroyer, and Conan the Victorious. We have a little extra time on the Book Nook this morning. Coming up, I'm going to bring you an interview with a gentleman who appeared on the program 5 years ago, and he died last month. Are you missing baseball? Well, we're going to bring you a little baseball talk coming up right after this. We're going to close out the Best of the Book Nook today with an excerpt from an interview I did back in 2015 with a sports writer, a longtime sports writer from the Cincinnati area. His name was Lonnie Wheeler. He died last month at the age of 68. He wrote a lot about baseball, and he loved the Cincinnati Reds. Are you missing baseball? Here we are in July, and there's no baseball. Pretty weird, isn't it? Everything is weird. Well, if you're missing baseball, we're going to give you a little baseball talk here. When I spoke to Lonnie back in 2015, he had just published a book called Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. Let's listen now to Lonnie Wheeler, the late Lonnie Wheeler, on the Best of the Book Nook. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into this journalism / writing game?
Well, I've been in journalism, seems like, forever. I grew up in St. Louis, and then when I was in high school, we moved to a small town in northern Missouri, Kirksville, and had a daily paper, and I would read the paper in the sports section, and I recognized that it wasn't written and compiled at all like the St. Louis sports sections that I was accustomed to. So I walked into the office one day and said, I think I can do this. And they had me rewrite a story on a college doubleheader that had just been played up in the old attic and looked at it and said, okay, you're hired. And so that was when I was a junior in high school, and then went to University of Missouri for journalism, and have pretty much been doing it, you know, for the last almost 50 years.
Okay, this book, Intangible, what was the idea behind it? What made you decide to write this particular book?
When the Post went out of business, and Cincinnati Post in 2007, I had worked for the Post for 8 years, I guess, and you're accustomed to attending and viewing games objectively from a journalistic standpoint without a rooting interest. And when I didn't have a newspaper to answer to any longer, I was able to cultivate a little bit of a rooting interest. And, of course, the Reds are the team on TV every night. And they were sort of in transition at that time. That was around 2008. And I just began to become enthused about the culture they were creating with younger, more enthusiastic players and demonstrating the qualities I think any fan believes in as you watch the game, but sort of there's an article of faith that you trust that enthusiasm and playing the game right and those things will make a difference. You want them to, but particularly in the current climate of sabermetrics, those things are sort of overlooked, if not dismissed. And I didn't think with all the work and research that had been brought to bear on baseball in the last years, really none of it had looked upon the small, subtle, unmeasurable qualities that contribute to the game. And I wanted to see if I could follow it for a period of years, a few seasons, and really chronicle and monitor and demonstrate, not prove, but demonstrate the fact that those things, the small things that we've all come to believe in, really do matter. They really do help you win games. And the Reds were a pretty good laboratory for that to happen, to watch them every night and monitor their transition and their culture change.
Lonnie Wheeler joins us. His new book is Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. And we're winding down another baseball season. We're in September. The weather's still pretty hot. The last of the dog days of summer. We hadn't had a baseball book on the program all season, and we thought, well, we better do this because we got a lot of...
Wow, you just made it under the wire.
We got a lot of baseball to talk about here. And I understand one thing that got you interested in baseball again was the fact that your daughter was interested in watching and learning about it.
Probably 8 years ago when I started this project. She was home at the time and able to watch games with us, and she took a rooting interest, and it was, you know, something to share a little bit. I previously hadn't really been home much at nights when games were on and able to watch with my family, and my wife was interested in watching the games too, and they looked at the game a little differently. The qualities that I was interested in were important to them. The personalities were important to them, and so that provided a little context that I think was helpful in this. And then, you know, the Reds, I mentioned, were in transition at that point. Walt Jocketty had just taken over as general manager, and he understood that the Reds were in need of a culture change. They were in the period where it was toward the end of the prevalence of Ken Griffey Jr. and Adam Dunn. The team had no success for, you know, the decade or so when they had been kingpins on the team. And while those two were enjoyable guys and great players, they really didn't set a tone that was instructive and useful to the younger players that the Reds were trying to build with. And so Jocketty took the pretty dramatic step of trading both Griffey and Dunn, who were leaders of the team just by their stature and presence, but really didn't choose to be. And it was no fault of their own. That was just not a role that they naturally embraced. And so what really, I think, kicked off the culture change for the Reds was moving both Griffey and Dunn to other teams and letting younger players gradually assume leadership roles, like players like Brandon Phillips and Joey Votto and Jay Bruce.
This is a very nuanced look at baseball. You examine all these different situations and all these teams and particular players, and there are certain players that just have that intangible thing, aren't there?
Yeah, there are, and you say it's very nuanced. It is, and it's very complicated. There are unquestionably players that bring qualities to a team that are useful, that are sanguine, that rub off on other players. There's a communicable thing about their approach, their attitude. Scott Rolen, when acquired by the Reds, certainly brought that to the table in Cincinnati. But what makes it so complicated is that those same qualities in a player will not play the same way on every team they're on or in every setting that they're in. A certain team that the sort of the chemistry of personalities may require the introduction of some other element that really sets it off, activates their talents. In the case of the Reds, I think Jocketty was astute enough to recognize that Scott Rolen brought a veteran presence and sort of a hard-nosed professional attitude to the team that was instructive and helpful. If you take Roland's veteran qualities and place that on a veteran team, say like the Yankees when they had Derek Jeter and Jorge Posada and Andy Pettit, so forth, his value would be diminished because those Yankee players didn't require the lessons, the personality traits that Rolen brought to the table. So you can't simply look at a player and say he has all these intangible qualities, he would be a great addition and improve our team. Generally speaking, yes, but it's not a one-size-fits-all exercise.
Lonnie Wheeler joins us. His book is Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. And when I started reading it, I immediately thought, you know, he better mention this one particular player because in my mind, this guy is a classic example of a great guy to have on the bench, a guy that it seems like everywhere he goes, he helps the team. A lot of times he gets traded at the trade deadline. And so I went and I looked at the sports headlines from last night, and I saw this headline, and it said, after dropping the series opener, the Royals managed 34 hits and 27 runs in taking
You're
the next two games.
You're talking about Johnny Gomes, aren't you?
Yep. Perhaps coincidentally, their offense came alive in the two games that Johnny Gomes started after his arrival in a trade from Atlanta. Gomes had an RBI double on Wednesday night and two hits on Thursday night, including another run-scoring double. Now, to me, he is absolutely the epitome of one of these kinds of players.
I agree wholeheartedly. And there are a handful. I mean, David Eckstein was like that. That Orlando Cabrera, the same. You know, Reds had him for 1 year. Is it coincidence? Everywhere they go, just about, the team ends up in the playoffs or the World Series. And of course, you know, they're not going to bring a last place team to first place.
Mm-hmm.
But players like that rub off. There are qualities about them that are contagious and it's sort of raise all the boats in the clubhouse. That was conspicuous when Gomes was in Cincinnati, and he talked about it. He was one of the guys we interviewed for the book. And he was talking about how a little thing like just, you know, hustling hard to first base, and you see a guy beat out an infield roller, and you say, yeah, I want to do that.
Mm.
And so, you know, just by witnessing, watching and experiencing that other player, it raises your standard of effort. Gomes had been known for the same thing in Tampa, where a culture change very definitely occurred. Can't say he was the leading piece of it. That credit would probably go to Joe Maddon, the manager. but the Rays had been a doormat, and Madden described it as a sort of a country club atmosphere where losing was accepted. There was no urgency. Well, a guy like Gomes exudes urgency, and he sort of triggered it in a preseason when he was involved in a brawl during spring training, with the Yankees. And it sent a message that you know, even though we're the Rays and these are the mighty Yankees, we're not going to lay down for these guys anymore. We're going to take them on. Gomes was a guy who other players knew for having their backs at all times, and he willingly accepted his role on a team. Even if he wasn't playing 150 games a year, he understood that he could contribute in many other ways and has everywhere he's gone. You know, when you look at what has happened to the Reds in the last few years, last 2 years in particular, have been pretty dismal. And in the 5 years I traced their arc from 2008 through 2012, they were pretty much on the rise. And you would think that culture still exists, and I'm sure it does, you know, in Walt Jocketty's mind in an organizational way. But there has been slippage, obviously. And, you know, what is that attributed? Well, it's hard to say, but coincidentally or not, Dusty Baker is gone as manager. Johnny Gomes is gone. Scott Rowland is gone. Bronson Arroyo is gone. Francisco Cordero, all guys who are very principal to the mentality, sort of the team culture, when the Reds were succeeding, are not here anymore. I know it would be easy to say to look at the numbers and attribute the decline to other things, and all those things play a part. But it's also anecdotally, it's not hard to suspect that the loss of players like Gomes and Rowland, et cetera, have played a part in the decline of the Reds.
That was Lonnie Wheeler talking about his book Intangible, recorded back in 2015. Lonnie died last month, and I'm going to read a little bit from his obituary in the New York Times, which was written by Richard Sandomir, who appeared on this program a few years ago with another baseball book. He writes, "Mr. Wheeler left his sports writing job at the Cincinnati Inquirer in the late 1980s and was soon working on I Had a Hammer, the Hank Aaron story. In its opening pages, he described in Mr. Aaron's voice the day he left home to play in the Negro Leagues, his first step to becoming one of Major League Baseball's greatest players and, for 31 years, its career home run king. The day I left Mobile, Alabama to play ball with the Indianapolis Clowns, Mama was so upset she couldn't come to the train station to see me off. She just made me a couple of sandwiches, stuffed $2 in my pocket, and stood in the yard crying. I was barely 18 at the time," he added, "a raggedy kid who wore my sister's hand-me-down pants and had never been out of the black parts of Mobile." Mr. Wheeler later recalled that he struggled at times to transform Mr. Aaron's voice from their interviews to the pages of the book. "If he said something one way, how could I write it differently?" he said in an interview with the New York Times. "But I was there to make the subject more literary. The way people talk isn't the way you write. I wrote it in something reflective of his voice." After working on I Had a Hammer, a New York Times bestseller, Mr. Wheeler collaborated with Bob Gibson, the famously intimidating St. Louis Cardinals pitcher, on Stranger to the Game, his autobiography. It was the start of a long connection with them. They later collaborated on 60 Feet, 6 Inches, a dialogue about baseball between Mr. Gibson and the slugger Reggie Jackson. And Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game, an account of Game 1 of the 1968 World Series, in which Mr. Gibson struck out a record 17 Detroit Tigers in a 4-0 victory. In 60 Feet, Mr. Wheeler wrote that Mr. Gibson's mystique rests with the serious, aggressive demeanor he displayed during his playing career. Lonnie Wheeler, he loved his baseball. He loved his Cincinnati Reds. He died last month in the Cincinnati area at the age of 68. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.